Stephen, you mentioned the big changes posed in the last 10 years, certainly on the capital that you've got to set aside, and I would imagine we can throw the regulations in there. Is the amount of regulation in banking at the moment that you're dealing with? And I listened to Lungisa Fuzile at Standard Bank telling me the only thing that they hire, the only department that's increasing in headcount is the compliance department. Are we getting to the point where we're starting to push, because of this, the high level of regulation, we're starting to push risk away from the banks that are the well-regulated entities in our society to the fringes where we don't know, we can't see?
Yeah, I think there is a risk of that.
The shadow bank, the so-called shadow bank.
I don't think that's... You don't hardly have that in SA. But if you go internationally, you've got... Although I'm not that worried about it, because what it is instead of, you know, elements of securitization, which what caused the financial crisis was they packaged loans and they created multiple tranches.
Right.
Okay, and then they took the riskiest piece of the loan portfolios and they created another securitization called a CDO.
And slapped it with the rating.
And then they took a CDO, they took CDOs on top of CDOs, and they created a thing called CDO squared. Okay. Then they said, the rating agency said, no, it's diversified. There was no way it was diversified. If house prices dropped 55% like in Ireland, you know, whoever held that paper, even if it was rated AAA, was gone. If you held the real AAA of the underlying, you probably didn't lose. But if you held anything above AAA of the underlying direct loan, you got a smack. And so I don't think you've got that situation, because the rules are very tough on securitization. These things called CDOs are gone. But what you have is private equity raising credit funds, or fund managers having big credit funds.
Right.
But the credit funds don't have a liquidity issue. It's just that, you know, if they take a smack, are institutional investors or private investors, whoever invests in these things, not going to get very grumpy.
Because they can't take their money out.
They get closed. They get gated because it's not liquid. And those are the rules. You can't just come and get your money. So these things have timelines. So, and then when it comes to the end of the timeline, say it's a 7-year fund, are they going to be able to liquidate the fund with a pool of assets that they've got? Are the assets liquid enough? Because they give a loan for 5-6 years, you have trouble in the market, and then that loan can't get repaid in 5-6 years. So that's where you may get some kind of a crunch, which I think will be more it will be harder to borrow money, so more like a liquidity crunch. And stuff then may flow back onto the bank balance sheets, but at a different pricing structure. But yeah, I think you have had a big build-up in off-bank balance sheets into unregulated environments. And, you know, when you have trouble, is there stuff that's going to come out of there that was abused? So are people going to take losses because there was abuse? But I don't think it's like, you know, the money fund used to own securitization assets, which were CDOs, which were totally liquid, and now they need to get their money back because someone's demanded repayment or they've had a run on the fund. I don't think you've got that situation. If you remember, Paribas to close 3 money funds in 2008.
Which started the whole...
It was 2007, actually.
Yeah, July 2007.
I know, I'll give you the date. 9th of August, 2007. They closed 3 money funds. I remember this very, very clearly, because we just bought Kensington, and now all of a sudden, Paribas closed 3 money funds. Now, Kensington's business was origination, package, securitized.
Right.
None of our clients lost, no one lost money on Kensington. I mean, UK house prices only came off 19%, and then by the time all the stuff unwound, the house prices recovered, so no one lost money on Kensington. But it still gave us help because we had a fund, because you couldn't securitize anymore.
Okay.
We were lucky, we were very liquid going in. So we were able to navigate our way through this trauma.
We're going to talk about that now. I want to just intersperse the interview with those short questions that we spoke about.
Sure.
You told me off air here that you don't read too much on business. You enjoy more the financial history, economic history.
Yes.
Best book you've ever read on in that field, in that subject?
Well, I can't remember. You know, I've read multiple books on the financial crisis. And I think that was very good learning.
You're a student of the financial crisis.
Yeah. Because I lived through it. I was in Washington at the IMF when, you know, you had partners in some of the global investment banks running around panicking because they didn't know if they'd have a job tomorrow. And the Oaks were saying to their wives, take as much money out of ATMs as you possibly can so that I've got a bit of cash to restart if I lose my job. That was the outright panic. I had a client who was not a South African, and for an international client, who said to me, you know, in the midst of the financial crisis, I'm only going to put my money with two banks, HSBC and JP Morgan, and that's not good enough. I want it in dollar bills in the vault. I don't want anything with the bank. I only trust Uncle Sam. You know, that's how many people were. They were in outright panic. And, you know, I'm Jewish, and that's why I stopped eating seafood in 2008 when they saved the world. When Paulson in the US and Timmy Gartner, and in the UK you had actually Gordon Brown's good job he did,
yeah,
with Alistair Darling was the finance minister, and then the rest of the heads of the central banks, it was the Frenchman who ran the European Central Bank. All these guys got together and they put a line in the sand. And they underpinned the world. And that's why I said, okay, I've got to give up something to thank the uncle for having allowed the world to sort itself out in an orderly fashion. Because you did not know where this thing was going to go. It was all sitting around. What happened with Morgan Stanley? The Japanese were going to invest $9 billion.
Yeah.
But you never knew where they were or they weren't. And if Morgan Stanley went, you would have had another round of problems.
So was that one of the questions I wanted to ask you?
In Washington at the IMF, they were all being called home. So I read all those books. What's his name?
Michael, The Big Short.
I've read The Big Short and all his other books, Michael Lewis, because he's interesting. If you read his original book, Liar's Poker, it was
Salomon Brothers.
About Salomon Brothers.
Yeah.
Okay, so but he always gives an interesting spin on it. But there was the proper research books.
Okay.
That were done by Sorkin, which was
Too Big to Fail.
Yeah, that was
the New York Times guy. Yeah,
yeah, that was a very good book. But there were multiple books. I can't remember all of them, of the ones I read.
What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a book called Thou Shalt Innovate, which is around Israeli technology and the role it's played in lots of technology.
Right.
In the world.
Okay.
In fact, the fellow who wrote it lives in Washington, and he was here the other day talking to our clients.
Oh, right.
So I spoke to him for 2 minutes, but I'm only halfway through.
Okay.
Then I read a very good book, which I tell people to read, which is called 40 Autumns. It's like a novel, but it's a true story about a family who, from East Germany, after the Second World War,
right,
when they all went home, and they landed up on the East German side. They were all educators, teachers. The father was a principal, very high-profile guy in the village, and the one daughter couldn't handle the oppressive nature or the authoritarian nature of the regime, and she escaped to the West. Because, you know, up until 1960 or 61, there was no war.
Right.
You could sort of get across. Look, you risked a bit because there were guards, but this young girl at the age, I think 18, got to the West, and then it's about the life of the two families. Her family, which landed up in the US, and her parents' family.
That stayed
in East Germany. And why it's called 40 Autumns, because it took 40 years for them to be reunited as a family. And it just shows the difference between an open society and a closed society, and how the one grows and develops and the other, you know,
stagnates,
yeah, even with intelligent people, same people, same culture. And so I tell people to read it because it shows you where you can go, in what can happen to you if we go down the wrong road as a country and we believe all this populist rubbish that some of these guys talk to you. I mean, you've got Venezuela, okay? Venezuela, under a populist leader, also wears hats and uniforms, and okay, he's since died. Where that country has gone with 1,000% inflation, or 2,000, or 3,000, I don't even know what the number is. Doctors have to go, or cleaning toilets in Miami, because they have to get out. So it's you know, these I like these stories because they tell you, you know, about what happened in the world. And you know, history often repeats itself. And if we're not students of history, we don't really understand how to avoid making the same mistakes. Generations forget.
Right.
So I read a lot of those books.
Okay. Just coming back to that that short question.
Yeah.
Biggest shock in your career, sitting in Washington, listening to these executives at banks?
No, they are. I've been through five crises. I remember when P.W. Buerta was so-called supposed to cross the Rubicon and announce the end of apartheid, then he went back. Then you had, they brought back the two rands, the commercial and the financial rand.
Right.
And South Africa defaulted on its debt. Okay. Then I lived through the 87 stock exchange crash. You know, then you get the other side of the coin when you had Madiba released from prison and South Africa moving towards the end of the apartheid. And we bought Sekold, where one of the guys running a trading book had a struck, had over committed himself on a thing called a short strangle, where he was short the market below a level and long the market. He was between 3.6 and 3.8. So if it went below 3.6, he would lose money. If it went above 3.8, he would lose money. And then with Madiba released, with life, South Africa starting to look good for foreign investors, saying we're going to, South Africa's going to be a growth economy, the stock market ran from 3.6, 3.7 to 4.2, and they went broke. And we took them over a weekend. Okay, so I've seen it all. You know, you've seen the 97 Asian financial crisis, 98 Russian-Brazilian crisis, which really hurt us when Dr. Stolz put rates up to 25%. And then you had the Sambo story, and then all the small banks. That I found that was tougher than the financial crisis.
Oh, really? That small bank crisis?
Yeah.
A2
banking crisis. Because you had someone like Board of Executives, which was a very good firm, you know, have a run on them. And then Nedbank took them over, and Tito was then the Minister of Finance, Governor of the Central Bank, announced a blanket guarantee for Board of Executive liabilities. That's how he stopped the run. That government guaranteed the liabilities, and then Nedbank took it over.
Right.
Because they had previously made the mistake of not bailing out Sambo that caused, you know, it starts getting like a felt fire.
Yeah.
Or it starts running. And so, you know, we were in the midst of this, and how did we defend ourselves as Investec? And the next ones that it was going to eat up was APSA or us. And I called a special shareholder, I had a special Investec on a Monday, where I told the world what Investec was, looked like, and that stopped the problem. Because this problem, it was building momentum. And then, you know, even in 2008, you know, people are saying, well, you know, RBS have got in trouble, Lloyds are in trouble, Barclays in trouble, all those building societies in trouble. And so why is Investec okay? That's what we were getting.
Now on that note, looking back,
yeah,
that's one of the things I scribbled in terms of the contribution to the growth of the organization. Conservative and prudent balance sheet management. Stephen, you've always been a fan of having a very, very liquid and diverse liabilities book.
Yeah, because when you come and ask for your cash, you must be able to give it to them.
That was informed by a thesis that you wrote, as I understand it.
For my MBA. I did an MBA at WITS between 1979 and 1991. I was on the first part-time program. So I joined Investec part-time in 1978. So back,
okay.
Okay, and I full-time in 1980. And I decided, because I was going into the banking industry, because I became a bank in 1980, I wanted to understand bank failure. So I did a thesis on bank failure in South Africa. To do that thesis, I had to study bank failure in other parts of the world.
Right.
Because in a place like the US, you had a very low incident of bank failure. In the 50s, 2 banks per 10,000. In the 60s, 3. In the 70s, a little bit more. And then you had this big banking crisis in the latter part of the 70s with the savings and loans institutions. And South Africa had a thing called Rand Bank, which had gone broke, and a few other banks would have gone broke. And GT, Lowry, and
Paul
had taken over RMB, which Jan Rupert owned. Jan Rupert managed to own it. I don't know how he got it from Rand Bank, but he owned it. And Rand Bank had gone broke, and RMB had survived because Jan had taken it over, and then he did a deal with GT, Lowry, and Paul when they bought their firm called RCI. And so we'd seen all this, and then the question was, what causes banks to go broke? Okay, and what generally causes banks to go broke is exactly what we've seen with VBS. Is you used to get a group of shareholders, used to get control of the bank, and then use the liabilities for normally their own property developments or their own businesses. And that's what happened in the savings and loans story in the US. These guys were business people, got control of a bank, they didn't have to go and borrow from the bank anymore. They took the depositors and they used it for their own purpose. So I learned quite a lot from that. And that was, you know, how do you diversify a bank balance sheet? How do you maintain your liquidity? How do you make sure that the asset side of the balance sheet is solid? That when you lend money, you're going to get your money back. And that you have, like, the right kind of collateral. And so that was my basis, that was my thesis. And, you know, banking was much more primitive in those days. So it's more complex now, because then you had, you know, bearings. Why did bearings go broke? You had a branch.
Hong Kong.
Yeah, well, Singapore, a million miles away, with one guy there. And
taking risks.
Well, he went negative as a trader. You got to watch his guys, and then he started doubling up to get out. And then they ran out of cash. So
that thesis, looking back now, keeping that large amounts of surplus cash available on the balance sheet, diversifying the depositor base. That saved this place a couple of times. Do you think?
Oh yeah, because you always had a lot of cash. So when you had people wanting their cash back, you give them their cash back. The worst thing you can do is not give them their cash back. So we've always lived with a high degree of liquidity. Even Ian Cantor in his early days used to say, I want my deposits to be a high percentage of my loans. My cash to be a high percentage of my deposits. We had a guy, Sir Chips Keswick, in Hambro. We bought Hambro's PLC and he joined our board. He's chairman of Arsenal. He's actually chairman of Arsenal still. And he always used to say, you know, your loan deposit ratio. He was an old style banker. So old style bankers understood this, that you must have deposits. Don't just rely on money market. This is really what...
Small sticky deposits as well.
Yeah, diversified. What really hit Leon at African Bank was he relied on the institutional market. And so he had no liability base when they started getting nervous. When the stuff started maturing, he couldn't roll it. Even though he'd done a big write-off. So because they started attacking him on, you know, is his provisioning adequate? So that's why, you know, you must have a diversified deposit base. So we very cautious on wholesale. We limit the amount of wholesale, but obviously we have wholesale, and you know, we also build a lot of retail.